Hello, I am Sebastian Teotrio.
And I'm Alex Hollingsworth.
Welcome to The Hidden Curriculum,
a podcast where we talk about all the stuff you didn't learn in graduate school. Hey, everyone. I hope that you had a great week. This week, we're really excited to bring you an episode. But before we get into that, Sebastian, how are you doing today?
I'm doing really well. I had my job market paper, finally got accepted.
Five years later, guys.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe my recommendation tip is going to be about that. And I'll talk about that later.
So I will ignore a banter question for today. We'll just like celebrate the glow of your job market paper being accepted.
Did it.
Awesome. Well, our special guest today is Julian Reif. Julian is an assistant professor of finance and economics in the Geist College of Business at the University of Illinois. He's also a senior scholar at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs and a faculty research fellow at the National Bureau of Economic Research. His research focuses on health policy evaluation and the value of health and longevity. Julian received his PhD in economics from the University of Chicago and his BA from Vanderbilt. There you go, Sebastian.
Woo!
Julian, Vanderbilt, how are you doing today?
That's right. Go Doors.
I'm doing great. My street was finally snow plowed, and we're back up to double digit temperatures here in Champaign. So I can't complain.
That's like amazing. That's like Midwest Cancun or something.
Yeah, balmy by standards of the last week.
So we always like to start by sharing a fun fact with our audience. Do you have a fun fact you are willing to share about yourself?
Sure. So I love playing the piano. And it's always been my dream to own a grand piano. And one of the smarter things I did prior to the start of the pandemic was to purchase my very own Yamaha grand piano.
That is awesome.
Yeah, it's been just, you know, a lot of fun to play. You know, it sounds way better than the beat up old uprights I played.
So wait, the grand piano is like the big thing with like kind of like the curvature kind of thing? Or
yeah, that's right. Yeah, so it's as opposed to an upright, which stands straight vertically, it goes out. It's very long, so it takes up a lot of space.
How did you move that?
For a long time, yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah. Wow, that's awesome. I want to go to your house so you can delight us as guests with
something. Oh, you're welcome. Once this pandemic is over, everyone is welcome to come over.
And when are you releasing your album?
So, well, might be a little while still.
Okay.
Focusing currently also on having my kids learn how to play. So they've been starting their lessons now. They've been mostly over Zoom because of the pandemic. But it's been a lot of fun, you know, watching them learn how to play, get excited about new songs.
That's cool. I never actually thought like music lessons are actually one thing that like maybe they don't work as well across long distances via Zoom, but are capable of still being done via Zoom. That's pretty neat.
Yeah, you can do it as long as you set your iPad up so they can see the keyboard. And I mean, part of it is just that your kid doesn't want to ever learn from you, right? It needs to be somebody else. They're not going to listen to me. So I think that's a big part of it.
It's just another human.
It's also now very, like, I imagine people walk into your house and maybe they were always impressed, but now it's like, now you're like so sophisticated. You know, like once you have a grand piano, it's like,
you get like champagne upon entry.
Yeah. Exactly.
They do look very nice. I mean, I think some people, you know, who just have, you know, money to waste, they like to buy them as artwork or something. So,
right.
Well, that is fun. But before we dive into today's topic, we'd love to hear about your work or anything else you want to promote. Is there anything you want to spend a couple minutes sharing with our listeners?
Well, I did have a paper recently conditionally accepted at AER Insights.
Nice.
I'm pretty excited. Congratulations.
So I could talk about that briefly. So
yeah, let's do it.
So that's co-authored with Jason Huff from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. And the paper has to do with determinants of risky behaviors among teens. So there's a lot of great descriptive work on this topic, you know, like recent studies documenting a rise in suicide rates among teens, but we don't really have a lot of great causal evidence on the determinants of risky behaviors, like youth drug use, for example. Mm-hmm. In general, the topic's been a little bit less studied than risky behaviors among adults, which has received a lot of attention in part because of the recent opioid epidemic. Mm-hmm. So in our paper, what we do is we look at what happens to teenagers when they get a driver's license. And so this is a nice setting for two reasons. First, you know, it's an important moment in the life of a teenager.
Oh, yeah.
And you gain a lot of freedom and it becomes easier to hang out with your friends and stay up late because you don't need an adult to drive you around. Mm-hmm. But it also means that it might be easier to get access to drugs. And if there's a big change in your social environment, right, then there may also be some mental health changes as well.
Right.
And so the second reason is a nice setting to look at is that because, as I'm sure you're aware, driver's license eligibility depends just on your age. So it's perfect for estimating a regression discontinuity, which is exactly what we do in the paper. We get data from Ad Health, which allows us to measure driving behaviors. And we also get about 30 years of death record data from the vital statistics, which allows us to look at teenage mortality. And then in the paper, essentially what we do is we compare outcomes for teenagers who are just above the minimum driving age to outcomes for teenagers who are just below the cutoff. And we have three main findings, two of which probably won't surprise you at all. So the first thing that we find is that about 25% of teenagers get a driver's license in their first month of eligibility. And we show that there's also an increase in actual driving as well. The second finding is that the total mortality jumps by 15% at the minimum driving age cutoff. And this is mostly explained by motor vehicle fatalities, as you would expect. But, and this is our main novel result, we also discover a large increase in drug overdose deaths. So we dig into this in the paper, and it's clearly concentrated among females. The effect is enormous in relative terms. So we estimate that female drug overdose deaths rise by over 70% at this minimum driving age cutoff.
And just to interject here, I saw your figures of this when you originally posted it on Twitter, and I assume that they're somewhat similar. It is really stark and really evident in basically the raw data plots like you'd want to see in RD. It's like, it is massive, but it's also like very clear that it's happening.
Yeah, no, it's very, very visible. You know, p-value is very, very small.
And why is it intuition, sorry, that for females you see such a big effect, but not for males?
So that's a good question. So I think, so we've looked into this a little bit, but we don't have a completely satisfactory answer to that. So what we do know, again, from sort of descriptive work, if you just look at the basic statistics on this, is that, you know, drug overdoses do make up a disproportionate share of teenage female deaths. And in general, teenage female drug overdose patterns look very different from male ones. Right. So I think one thing that seems pretty clear is that teenage driving is one of the causal factors that's contributing to these behavioral differences between teenage males and females. But we don't really have a lot of good evidence on what the exact mechanism is, right? Is it that, you know, when the teenager gets a car, they're able to more easily purchase drugs, for example, and somehow it's affecting females more than males? We're not sure. We unfortunately don't have data in this paper, at least, to dig into that. But we think it's a really important question. We're hoping to maybe tackle it in follow-up work.
All right. So before we sort of get into the full topic of the day, and I guess this is going to be kind of related to what we're going to talk about today. So we'll sort of probably flow from this one into the other. We generally like to ask people like first, like, you know, how do you work? What's your workflow? And I hopefully not your idealized day, but if it is just your idealized day you want to share, just please be cognizant and let us know. Just so people can get a little bit of a better idea of like, you know, you're a very productive person. How the heck do you do that?
Yeah.
Well, the first and most important thing I do every day breakfast. Is have a cup of coffee.
Okay.
Yes. The first real answer on the show.
Right. With caffeine, right? And with caffeine.
Yeah. Yeah. I am pretty worthless without my coffee. And then, you know, while I have that cup, you know, I'll read the news. I'll check Twitter. And then I look at my Google Calendar, see if I have any other meetings or mandatory events in that day. So I try really hard to keep my mornings clear and available for research and writing.
Okay.
So for me personally, the morning is when my mind is sharpest and I'm most able to concentrate.
And what time mornings are we talking about?
So it basically is declining monotonically throughout the day. So, you know, probably, you know, maybe 8:30 is when I'm sharpest. And then a little less sharp at 10:30, you know, by the time.
So you wake up around like 7 or 8?
I wake up at 6:30.
Oh, okay. So the morning routine is a little bit long in that sense.
You have kids, right?
Yeah. So I'll wake up and the first things is basically to try, you know, you got to feed the kids, drop them off at school, or at Zoom. You know, our school has been bouncing back and forth between in-person and virtual. So that, that has been causing some issues these days. But yeah, it'll take me usually about an hour and a half at least before I'm able to sort of sit down and get working.
How do you decide what you're going to work on that during that writing time? Is it coding? Is it writing? Is it both? Or how do you decide that?
So if I have writing to do, I typically do that first. I'll leave coding for later. I can do that usually at any point during the day. In terms of determining exactly what project to work on, I use my email as a to-do list. So I will look at my email every morning to see what tasks I'm working on. The way this works is I make very generous use of the snooze feature.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So this is definitely the best feature that Google has released in the last couple of years, in my opinion. So if I have some task I need to do, I keep it in my email. If I know that I can't get to it this week or next week or maybe even until next month, I will snooze it. So it comes back into my inbox next month and I don't forget to do it. Then anything that I'm thinking about working on this week, I just keep in my email. I will look at those items and I'll make a decision that morning. I try to prioritize anything that I'm the bottleneck on. So if my co-authors are waiting for something, I try to make that a priority. Any writing work I have to do, as I mentioned, I try to make a priority.
Yeah. That's interesting. You're the second person that's mentioned this email to do, which David Slutsky also does that, which I now, you know, the first time I'm like, that seems like a lot of emails like to handle, you know, because my email inbox started exploding, even though I still archive in this news, but I do keep my to-do list and email separate. But, you know, everyone has their method for their madness, right? So that's great.
And the snooze, as I mentioned, is very important here. I might have, 40 emails snoozed. So if you don't make good use of that, then yeah, it becomes, it's just too much. You look at your email, you have 100 messages, you forget which ones are important, etc.
I used, not like you did as a to-do list, but I was using Gmail and the snooze feature and loved it. And then my university switched away from letting me use Gmail and I lost the snooze button and it stinks.
It's a big loss. Yeah. I'll let your dean know this is not good for productivity.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, that's awesome. So that's a good way to for us to get to know your mornings. And then I guess the afternoon is just like random stuff like meeting or classes and all that kind of other stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. And if I have time available, I will do, I will be happy to, of course, do research in the afternoon as well. It'll probably be more coding. I find it's easier for me, especially if it's data cleaning, for example, to do that. Because it's not quite as creative as having to write or, if you're working on something theoretical where you really need to be at your sharpest.
And how many projects are you balancing at a given point in time? Have you found like a number that works for you or that really changes a lot?
So in terms of actively balancing, it maybe 4 to 5.
Okay.
And then there'll be, a couple that are sort of on the back burner a little bit, either because it's, we're still, if you're waiting for a field experiment to run, maybe something like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I would say that I'm actively thinking usually not more than 4 to 5 projects.
Okay. Gotcha. And I'm guessing you also use kind of the deadline stuff to push you to create drafts and all that stuff, like start submitting to conferences, for example.
Yeah. And a lot of it is coordination as well. So for example, if I'm writing up a paper, I benefit a lot from iterating with my co-authors. And so it's very helpful to have if there's a week where they're available, I will try to rearrange my schedule and make myself available. And I will say, okay, I'm going to write on Monday, then you're going to review my changes on Tuesday, then I will reiterate on Wednesday. I find there's a lot of complementarities to working actively at the same time when possible.
That's great. I'm a big fan of this idea that I think you're also a fan of too, of like trying to make things as reproducible as possible. But I find that I regularly, I'll code for a while, and by a while, I mean like a period of weeks or something. And then I will realize that my project has reached some state of chaos where there's some files in the wrong places or there's some accidental hard coding in there. And then I need to do a full cleanup to sort of get it back to that one button, click one button and it reproduces the whole project or something. I'm just curious, when you start a project, do you start with a template and then every day when you're done, you clean it up and make sure it's good? or like sort of how do you maintain this idea of replicability throughout? Or is it just something that you do at the very end?
So I will start with a template in the sense of a general organizational structure of I have a folder with scripts, I have a separate folder with read-only data. But I work very similar to how you just described in that if I'm trying to get to an answer quickly, as in, oh, I want to know, you know, if I work with these data, you know, is the sample size going to be large enough, or is this, you know, is the signal in the data large enough for actually there to be a paper? I will write that code quickly and fairly, and it might be fairly messy. But once I'm ready to start working on it more seriously, what the big thing I do is I will rewrite my code. I will rewrite my code multiple times during a project. So I think it's fine to have some messy code because it's faster, right? Mm-hmm. And so sometimes if I have a project, if I don't know whether or not this is going to be a long-term project, I'll put in a little bit less effort up front. But I rewrite code many times over the course of a project because the organization changes in terms of what kind of analyses we're running. And it's also just in general helpful to make. It's a good way to basically force yourself to quality check your own code. I might have something where I have a lot of lines of code that could be rewritten into a for loop. I didn't bother the first time because I was just trying to get it down really quickly. But now that I'm ready to make it cleaner, I will rewrite it in that for loop structure.
As I've like progressed and learned more about coding practices and stuff, because like it's kind of a shame in econ, a lot of this is like learning by doing. So you're out there like submitting papers before you're like learned to code maybe. But I've realized like, oh man, I should have written that code as a like function and then called that function many different times or something. And it's like, would be a much more parsimonious way or less error prone way of doing a simple task. Mm-hmm. It seems like you've done a lot of that too, like where you've like your tech save program I was using long before I ever met you. And it was just like, I did that just arrive from like, you needed to do this task many times.
And then, so I hate doing the same task more than once unnecessarily, both because it wastes time, but it also, I think it's inefficient, right? Because if you write one function very well, then you can debug it, right? And then all your future projects will benefit from that.
Yeah.
Right? So instead of having, you know, reusing the same code over and over again, I like to make one piece of code one time, make sure it works well, and then reuse it in my other projects.
Yeah. And that little bit there about the debugging, I think, is like key. And same thing with what you said about changing the organization of the project, where it's like you start one way, and then as soon as like an error arises, either because you changed your structure or because like you need some feature or just like a legitimate error occurs, you go fix the code, and then, but not for that one idiosyncratic situation, but so it can handle that idiosyncratic situation in addition to all the other stuff it could handle.
Exactly. And, and regarding, you know, rewriting your code, I view it a lot like writing a paper. I don't know about you two, but when I'm writing a paper, I usually end up rewriting it many, many times, right? The introduction the first time around looks oftentimes very little like the introduction in the final published version of the paper. And that's fine, right? Because you go through different iterations and you learn things. Code is the same way. With your first pass, you have a particular way that you're doing the analysis, and then how you're thinking about that may change down the road. And that's fine. Rewrite your code and it will be cleaner, more accurate, and more to the point at the end.
For our earlier career researchers, this is something that like you'll continue to grow. Like the way I organize, or the way I thought about clean code 5 years ago is very different from the way I think about clean code now. And every single project I learn one more step of like, oh, I need to organize this, you know, in a different way from the get-go. And I think do spend some time. If you're a person that is like averse to doing that, definitely spend some time on that, because each time, each project, you're going to get a little bit better and better. So that's great.
I had like the best experience recently where a PhD student told me, they were like, hey, I'm on my like third project. Like it's like their third class paper or something. And they're like, I'm finally understand why you made me or encouraged me to like, make all these tables dynamically and make all these figures. Like, I just copy and pasted my old stuff. Mm-hmm. And I did my project in like a weekend after I had the idea and the data was cleaned. And like, I get it now. I was like, yes. Like, I felt so good.
All right, great. So this is a good time to transition. So for our listeners of the podcast, what we're going to do now is we're going to go through Julian's guide. He has kind of like a Stata coding guide and also an R coding guide, but we're going to focus on Stata. And he has a lot of different steps that you can follow, and it's really easy to follow. But what we wanted to do today is to kind of like get us started there and maybe ask questions as we go through of the why we're doing this and the where we're doing it. We're obviously not going to go through the whole guide, but we're going to give like a nice overview. And we'll have it all as a video as well, so you can do it as we're doing it later on whenever you want to. So this is great for people who just are going to start a new project and maybe want to find a way to start being organized. When did you write this guide, by the way?
I think this guide is about 1 year old now. I should also emphasize that I'm updating it over time. So there'll be changes that'll be made to it, later this year and so on. Basically, whenever I update my personal organization structure, I update it on the guide. I try to keep them synced.
So there's a little motivation of why we want to do this. Things like minimize coding errors, automatic decreation of tables and figures, integrating Stata code with supporting for R analysis, which is great, and produce replication packages, which are obviously really cool and very important. There's also, I think, maybe an assumption that a lot of us use services like Dropbox or maybe Box.net that they can use to be synced across computers. And obviously that makes things a lot easier when you're using different computers or across different co-authors. So the first step is to set up a Stata profile. Can you tell us, Julian, what a Stata profile is?
Yeah, so the Stata profile is essentially just a script that Stata automatically runs every time you open it. So when you open up Stata, if you have a Stata profile set up, it'll tell you running, cadu personal profile.do. And any code that you put into that script will be automatically executed. And so it's very nice for putting automated things that you will want available to you every time you open Stata.
Great. And so this is located, if you go, for example, I'm going to go to my PC, cadu personal, and then you'll find it right there. And on Macs, it should be around the same or similar file path, right?
Yes.
Okay, great. So I'm going to open this profile that I already created. And this is what I did. And let me ask Julian if this is maybe what they recommend. So I just set up a global of where in this computer Dropbox is that I call Dropbox. And so in another computer, this will be different. And same thing, I have OneDrive for Microsoft Office, and I do the same thing for that. And then the last thing that I do, and I don't know if I should do this in here or reverse, is to tell it to run this ADU that is called Stata Profile ADU, and I'll talk about what that is. So am I doing it right or am I doing it wrong?
Well, that's how I do it. So
I'll
call that right, at least for the purposes of this. But yeah, I think that, essentially the idea is anything that's specific to your computer, you want to put inside of this profile. And a lot of us who are sharing environments across Dropbox, you can put your, a secondary profile on Dropbox that you call from this one. And then you only have one profile you have to update each time.
So I just have two quick things. One is just an interjection. If you want to find out where your personal folder is on Stata, you can just type in sysdir, S-Y-S-D-I-R, and it'll tell you all the locations that Stata looks for different things when you open up Stata. And then the second thing is a question. So I've recently started using Stata projects quite a bit, which basically makes it so all of the files within Stata are relative. Now this doesn't have the ability to run commands. Like, so if I wanted to like set a certain scheme for graphs or something, every time I opened it up, the profile.do is going to be better for that. But do you have any thoughts on like, are projects good? Are they bad? Or are they just like not a part of your workflow yet?
Yeah. So the only thing I like to use that's defined outside of sort of the immediate project environment is just the global that points it to a project folder. I like having everything be self-contained personally. And so essentially the way I design my analysis is that if you were to download, one of my projects or one of my paper, one of the data and code repositories for a paper of mine, I want you to have to at very most change only a single line of code. And that's the line that defines where the folder is that you just downloaded to your computer. Right. And so you define where is this folder, and then you just click one script and everything will be reproduced automatically.
So I guess that's what I thought that the project was, is when you open it, it just tells your computer this is where the folder is.
So the well, I guess I'm not exactly sure what you're referring to, but the way the globals work, right, is that they're pointing to the directory that you're in. And so that's what I use to reference which directory you're
okay. In. So I think it's in newer versions of Stata, there's a new thing where you can like create a project, which is like similar to an R project that when you open it, it just takes you
there.
It's like, can your you way
tell
of
me how to do it
Stata.
Here, Alex, maybe.
So if you go to file.
Okay.
And then if you go to like new on yours, I'm not so sure. So on mine, when I go to file, I can go to new and then project. You have a PC, so it looks like your options are slightly different.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll have to figure that one out, because I've been told about this, but I've never seen it of how I can actually do it on a PC. Which
yeah. So on mine, it's basically, and it's on the Linux version and Mac. So those are the two that I use.
Okay.
But it has replaced the profile.do for me. But again, profile.do is useful for other reasons because it runs code. But I just wasn't sure if like there were other pros and cons of the project.
Okay. So one thing, the reason why I like this setup too, is because in any computer that I start, it'll actually tell the Stata where the Dropbox is. And that's really nice, because then you don't have to like be setting that over and over. So the next step is to create the Stata profile I do. So this is, let me go a little bit here back to the guy. So the guy said something about set variable abbreviation offs. What does that do? Because I did not include that on mine.
So in Stata, you can refer to variables in an abbreviated manner if you want. Mm-hmm. So for example, suppose you have a variable called price in mm-hmm. your data set. And instead of saying replace price equals 3, you could say replace PR equals 3.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, mm-hmm. it would know what you're referring to. Mm-hmm. All right. So that's convenient if you have long variable names, but it can also cause problems, right?
Yeah.
Where your code runs, because you only have one variable named price, but then you add another variable, let's say probability. Mm-hmm. And now when you say PR, Stata doesn't know which one you're referring to, and it will generate an error.
So it's just a good practice to not use abbreviation, et cetera.
Yeah. I think it's a setting that, in my opinion, should be by default off. I think for historical purposes, going back to variable versions of Stata, it's by default on.
This is great. I didn't know you could turn this off. And that says annoyed me or surprised me before. I'm like, how is this running? I found something similar.
So the next thing that we're going to do is we're going to create globals for each of your projects. So for example, if your project is called licensing or my project, you call the Dropbox variable with a dollar sign and then slash where the folder is. And so that's what I've done for these different projects. My question here is like, is that the only thing you do here in the Stata profile do, or you're going to add other stuff?
That's pretty much all I do.
Okay.
And so again, and this mostly goes back to, you know, my philosophy that I like everything to be self-contained within the project.
Okay.
So, cause I do not assume that when a user is, someone else is running my code, right, that they have a profile set up like I do. Right.
Mm.
So suppose I put in, you could, for example, put in some default settings for your graphs
right,
in your profile. Some people like to do that.
Right.
And the problem is if I'm working on a project with Alex, right, and Alex doesn't have those same settings, when he runs the code, it's going to output the graphs without those settings. So I don't like to have those settings be personal to me. So I basically, the goal for my profile is only to define where the different directories are, so that when I open up, I can run any script from any computer anywhere. But any user could just do that themselves by just defining that one global, which is where is the project located.
Right.
So it's pretty minimal.
I see. And so when you're like in do files, writing things, and you want to, let's say, use a data set for that project, you just type the global and kind of like data folder and then the name of the data set.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So one thing to be aware of about globals is that as their name suggests, they're global in scope. So when you define a global, it will be available and it will be referenceable inside of any script that you ever run in Stata, right? Mm-hmm. And so you don't want a lot of these names and variables floating around, because eventually they might conflict with each other. If I had 1,000 of these, right, then maybe all of a sudden one of them is going to interact with something else that somebody else has defined inside of the same project. So you, I try to keep these fairly minimal because they cannot conflict with any other global in any other project that I have.
Okay, gotcha. And then one issue also that I have, for example, is that in some projects, I'm going to use data or a data set that I cleaned from another project or something like that. And let's say I'm in a laptop where it doesn't, I'm not able to store a bunch of information. So do you have a way of addressing that, or you just try to keep all the data, you know, as self-contained as possible? Or maybe you don't find like space issues, so you haven't solved that in a while.
So I will try, if I have data sets that I'm that I plan to reuse, I have a special data folder on one of my data drives. With, for example, for the vital statistics data, which I've used in several different projects, I have all the raw data on this data drive.
Okay.
And I can have multiple projects pulling from these raw data sets if I want to.
And that in that global, you define it here in a data profile?
Yeah, so I would. So that would be a global. I think I just call it research data or something.
And then another way of handling that same thing, but it's a little more prone to error, is to create like basically shortcuts. So like on a Unix system, you can make a symbolic link. So like I have used the same mortality data and it's pretty big. So I basically keep it on one spot on my computer. And then in any project in my data folder, I create like a symbolic link back to that. So if you look at the actual folder structure, it will look like I've got that mortality data in that same project. I don't need a global for it, but really it's just referencing back. And now when you share with the co-author or do something, you need to be careful to make sure they have the same symbolic link set up. But like it's one way to reduce repeated raw data storage.
Gotcha.
And that's one more thing I will add is what I will also define here are, for example, the locations of confidential data sets.
Oh, nice.
Sometimes if I'm working, so actually for example, in the paper that I was describing at the beginning of our conversation, with Jason, we have confidential data from Ad Health. We don't store that data in our main project folder. That's there. It's stored separately on a hard drive off the network. And so we have some code that works with the data and cleans it, and it's referencing a global that's specific to that folder with the confidential data. This way, we make sure not to commingle any of the data sets.
So the next part that you have here on your guide is to create a folder structure that behaves well. So tell us a little bit about this folder structure.
So the structure starts with two folders. One is a folder called scripts. As the name suggests, this is where you put all of your scripts, whether they're written in Stata, R, or whatever. This essentially is all of the code that you would need to run your entire analysis from beginning to end. Okay. And then the other main input is data. And in here, you would put all of the starting data sets that you begin or that you begin using in your analysis. So this might be a file you downloaded from the internet or some Excel files with hand-coded variables in them. And the idea is that the data folder is read-only. You will never write any output from your scripts into that folder. You'll write those into separate folders like results or processed or something. And so you can always at any point delete every other folder in your project folders. You can delete the results folder, you can delete the process folder, and you're left with just scripts and data, and you rerun your analysis from scratch and it will regenerate everything. And
that is like the dream goal, right?
Exactly. So you can, you know, it's a good way to test, you know, if you have intermediate files and you think, well, I don't really need this intermediate file because it was produced, you know, from an original file in the data, then by deleting it and rerunning your analysis, well, first of all, that checks to make sure that's true. And this is a good way to ensure that you're not accidentally using some old intermediate file that maybe has old data in it and you thought you were using the newer data, but that actually wasn't true because, you know, you messed up a path reference somewhere.
Right. And okay, so I hear my kind of setup is I have data and what it would be scripts is two files. Do you also like have like folders like literature or, you know, presentations, things that are not necessarily code related, or you keep that also separate?
I have those folders. I store them one level up, which I think if you scroll down in the guide, there might be an example.
I see.
And so this is also done on purpose because this analysis folder event, the idea is that this eventually will become your replication folder.
Okay.
And in your application folder, you don't necessarily want your literature references or your manuscript, et cetera. I mean, you might want those, but you also might not. Also because my replication folder usually ends up being a separate folder for various reasons. For example, I'll have a paper where I have my analysis folder. I've run everything from beginning to end. Now the paper's published. And now the AEA data editor comes along and says, I need you to create a replication folder.
Right.
It's not an exact copy of my analysis folder because, for example, maybe I have confidential data that I'm not allowed to share. Right. So what I do is I just make a copy of analysis folder and then I rearrange things as necessary, usually moving some data sets out. But by having everything be separated like this,
it's easy to manage it. Right.
Exactly. And it's all still inside of whatever my project directory is.
Could you just walk through the basic logic of why we should be saving our user add-on programs in both Stata and in R? Because I think like this was, I had never thought about this. And as soon as I read your guide, I was like, this is obvious. And I now do this in every project, right?
Yeah. Well, I guess I could, I can push it even maybe even to a broader question of just what is the, you know, the reason all of these things were developed was essentially out of frustrations from when I was trying to reproduce papers back in graduate school. So, you know, that was, you know, for me about 10 or even 15 years ago now, right? I would go and I would download data from different papers and they would never run for lots of different reasons. But one of them is because if you have an add-on program, for example, Reg HDFE, which is a very popular one, if you download this add-on and use it and you don't include it with your code, then when someone else tries to download your code and run your analysis, they're going to get an error, right? Because they don't have the program. Now, you might say that's not a big deal. They just need to go and download it, right? SSC install Reg HDFE. But oftentimes these programs are being constantly maintained, right? Reg HDFE is an example. It's being improved over time. And even the best programs have bugs in them, right? And we like to fix those bugs. So the newer version may not actually produce the same results as the older version, right? And if that is in fact the case, when a user downloads your data and code and tries to replicate your results, they'll be unable to do so. And they won't know why, right? Maybe it's because there was a bug in this add-on program. Maybe it's some other error. But the way to ensure that this doesn't happen is to keep a copy of the add-on program, right? You should think of it just like as a piece of your own code. You need to have all of your own code to reproduce your analysis. You also need any other user code that you're using to reproduce your analysis.
And this means, just so everyone's aware, that like you will have maybe different versions, but maybe the same version of Reg HDFE installed in various places in your computer if you have multiple different projects, right? So that like basically, Julian's recommending here creating like a Stata packages folder and then installing all of your, when you SSC install, having it install into that location and then also calling just that location, not everywhere on your computer when you use it.
That's right. And the good news here is that add-on programs in Stata are very small in size. So this is not going to use up a lot of room on your computer. One of the challenges when you're working in R is that many of the add-ons are actually quite large in size.
Indeed.
So there are ways to address this issue in R as well, but they're a little bit more involved because it's not always very easy to just keep a copy of, for example, Tidyverse, which is hundreds of megabytes in size. And you also need one version for each operating system you're working on. The Stata add-ons are cross-platform by default. So you don't have to worry that, oh, I need to download, you know, a copy for Windows and for Unix. If it works on your Windows computer, it will run also on Unix and Mac.
And what you just mentioned about R is very true. So I work on R, I use R and I work across different operating systems and different versions of R. And there's this wonderful package called Renv, which is R-E-N-V, which basically automates this version control issue for you of the packages. But it is absolutely the case that I have like probably 10 gigabytes worth of like Tidyverse on my computer when I don't need that many.
So you keep them under scripts, right?
Yes. So the scripts folder keeps anything which is code related. And so what I recommend in the guide is essentially to have a subfolder in your scripts folder called, I think I called programs.
Yeah.
It's saying it's packages for the user add-ons. And basically inside of packages, will be a copy of every add-on that you've downloaded or that you use as part of your
project. And the key thing here, you can set the ado path right. file, which is basically you can tell Stata, hey, all the do files and all the ado files that I'm going to use are going to be in this particular location. And so that's the key thing here to be doing. And then you can do that on servers as well. And this is a nice way if you, let's say you have access to a server that has really good computational power, but you don't have access to the internet on the server, save through like the ability just to like upload files. You can like download the files onto your own computer. And then when you upload your code, you can also upload these user written packages and things.
Great. So after that, it goes into code about how to output tables, which obviously you guys can see there. I think maybe the last thing that I'll talk about really quickly here is the Stata coding tips, and I'll share it so you both see it. So really quickly, do you want to maybe go through each, not enough through each one of them, but highlight any of these that you think are important, maybe you get a lot of questions about?
Well, I think the one I will echo as being perhaps the most important is never use a hard-coded path. Okay. So this is probably something that all of us have encountered when trying to reproduce another paper. You download the code and it breaks because it's, you know, it's referencing, you know, a folder called user/Jane Doe. And then that's not, you don't have that folder, of course. Right? Mm-hmm. The way to get around this is to make use of these globals, right? Mm-hmm. So that way, again, you only have to change one line of code and everything else will just be in reference or in relation to that particular global. And you don't have to worry about running into errors.
All right, so I want to ask a bit about the motivation about why so much, like this is a costly effort to do this, right? This isn't something simple. You could easily have produced a number and then written a paper and then just been like, oh, the number is 2. So I want to know from a couple different points of view, what are the personal benefits of engaging in a costly sort of procedure of maintaining a clean house like this, but also what are some of the professional and sort of larger benefits for science of doing something like this? And do you think that those benefits, perhaps you do because you this coding guy, but why do you think those benefits outweigh the costs?
Well, I could talk a little bit about sort of my general philosophical or sort of perspective on this. I mean, this goes back to graduate school when I was trying to replicate papers. It was a very frustrating experience. Oftentimes the code would not run or would have errors or just not make sense. And imagine if you were reading a great theory paper that had elegant theorems. And then when you went to go look at the proofs, everything was messy and incomplete.
Just a piece of paper,
to the reader.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. It would probably make you rethink a little bit about the validity of the original paper. Right. And so, I mean, I don't want to push this analogy too far, right. But I do think that, you know, the code underlying a paper is a lot like a proof. Right. Mm-hmm. Many people don't want to read it. Right. And you may not need to read it. Sometimes even the reviewer may not need to look at your code to feel confident about the result. Right. Same thing about the proof for a theorem. Right? Mm-hmm. But it's an important part of the paper, right? And you know, even with theory, history is replete with examples of when there were errors in theory papers. Right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes these errors matter, sometimes they don't, but we obviously want to avoid them. Mm-hmm. And you know, so when my motivation for putting all this together was, you know, first and foremost to minimize mistakes in our analyses. Right? Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of times these mistakes end up not being consequential, but sometimes they are. Right. In any case, I think we can all agree that, you know, we want to get the right answer, right? And so having something that's organized makes it more likely that we're going to have the right answer. Mm-hmm. So I think that's probably the first and most important motivation for having a setup like this. I think, you know, there are some other benefits as well, in addition to, you know, having the right answer, which is itself a good benefit. I think it also makes it a lot easier to collaborate with multiple co-authors who may also these days be using different languages, right? Mm. You need to have some sort of folder structure that's consistent and can be used across different languages. And I designed this structure to work very well in that kind of environment.
Gotta be bilingual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's also something that the more you use, the easier it then becomes for the second and third projects, right? To have something standardized, right? Then the next time you work on it, you already know, okay, I don't have to explain that it's only read-only data sets that goes into the data folder. We did that on our previous project, right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, even beyond that, it also makes it easier to share your results and your code and your work with others, mm-hmm. right? And that has lots of benefits. So it has good benefits for our profession, right? So it's a social benefit because we get to build on other people's work, right? So if Sebastian has already put together a wonderful data set of, you know, some particular set of legal laws, let's say, mm-hmm. right? Well, I don't want to have to redo all of his work, but if I can just download
right.
his data and I have his code that rebuilds it from scratch, mm-hmm. so I can check it if I need to, or maybe make a tiny modification, that's a huge benefit to me. Mm-hmm. It's also going to be a benefit to Sebastian because I will mm-hmm. hopefully cite his work for this. And you know, also beyond that, this is becoming a formal requirement for publication in our profession. I think that will continue yeah. to be the case, right? So even if you don't think this stuff is a good idea, you know, if you want to publish in any of the AEA journals these days, you have to go through the AEA data editing process, which, by the way, I've designed this setup to be completely compliant with that, right? So if you follow this setup, it's going to be very easy to get through the AEA data editing process. Awesome. And so this is obviously still, all this is a work in progress, but this kind of stuff where you need a push button analysis, I think is going to become a requirement for most of our published papers going forward.
And I'll just say, like, personally, so I started, I love the idea of this push button replicability thing. And I adopted a couple of the things you mentioned, like the Stata packages and things, as soon as I saw them in your recommendations. And I recently had to go through the AEA data editing thing. It was fairly a breeze, you know, relative to, I think, how it could have been. But also I had some reviewer comments that I needed to deal with. And it was pretty easy to incorporate, like, they were hard and I needed to think about them, but like, it was pretty easy to incorporate the analyses into my existing structure and click run. I didn't have to rebuild things. Like, it was kind of mm-hmm. clean. It was clear what was going. So like, just for my own,
that's awesome.
Like, future you will benefit from previous you
so much.
Organization.
Oh. Yes, that is the hope.
Thank you so much for those insights. Every week, we like to ask our guests for our recommendation of the week. This can be anything, a podcast, a command, an app, a song, a quote, a book, a kitchen recipe, anything that improves your life in a small way. Jillian, what is your recommendation of the week?
So I recall Alex saying on an earlier podcast that he found that exercise provides him with a lot of physical and mental health benefits. Oh, okay. So I will first say that I'm the same way. Exercise and sleep are very essential for my personal productivity and well-being. And one thing I'll note is I've discovered that exercise is way easier when you have a good podcast to listen to. And so I can make a couple recommendations there. So of course, it's a hidden curriculum that goes without saying. But I have two podcasts that I like to listen to a lot are Conversations with Tyler and Mindscape. And so Conversations with Tyler is hosted by Tyler Cowen, who's an economist. Most of you are probably familiar with him. He interviews not just economists, but also writers, philosophers, chefs, a variety of different academics. Mm-hmm. Mindscape is hosted by Sean Carroll, who's a theoretical physicist. So he focuses mostly on scientists, although he ventures also in a couple other areas as well. And what I like about these podcasts is they're very interesting, first of all. I always learn a lot listening to them. Mm-hmm. They're a lot of fun to listen to. But also they really are nice examples of academics who are able to communicate, you know, complicated but important concepts to the public in a very intelligible manner. Mm. And I think that's something that many of us, certainly myself, could always do better at. And I think they provide just a wonderful example of that kind of communication.
Awesome. That's great.
That's great. Yeah, the host of Mindscape, Sean Carroll, I'm like halfway through his audiobook, Something Deeply Hidden.
And oh, yeah, that's his newest one. Yes.
I don't know if it's right because it's about quantum physics and quantum mechanics, but he certainly makes me think I understand what he's saying as he goes through. So
that's so funny.
Yeah, he's a big proponent of the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. He makes a good case for it, although I'm obviously not.
So like the MCU, right? There's different timelines. I don't know. Okay, whatever. Alex, what is your recommendation of the week?
So this is kind of similar to one I gave before about using like email templates for stuff, but this is one, like, I only have like two email templates. And since this is an episode about coding, I have a lot of like coding snippets and templates that I use. So like, I guess this is sort of like just use something like Julian's guide. But I actually use Sublime Tech a lot to like write LaTeX and to do other things. And I use a lot of coding snippets there. So like I have like a blank document that when I use like a keyboard stroke, it will like pop up with like a LaTeX document that's sort of got like the preamble of a title page and like all this other stuff ready to go. If you just like sort of type like I and then tab, it'll like start like create like the itemized list framework in LaTeX. I found this kind of stuff like just invaluable to reducing the cost for me writing, because I don't like writing that much. Mm-hmm. So anything I can do to reduce that cost is good.
That's awesome.
Yeah. What about you, Sebastian? Oh, sorry.
Yeah. My recommendation of the week is, and this is in line, maybe this is similar to what you're saying, Alex, but on Windows, I don't know if this exists on Mac, there is a program called Auto Hotkey Program. And you can do this in different ways, but I think that Auto Hotkey is very like foolproof. And the idea is that you can create a script where you put a shortcut. So for example, dash S, and then something else appears. So when I do dash Zoom, then the link for my Zoom room appears. Or when I do dash 30 minutes, the link for my 30 minute calendar meetings appears. And it's being like a really, I think, like awesome lifesaver. And like, it's really easy. And people are like, okay, where are we going? You know, let's jump into a Zoom. So I just do dash Zoom and immediately the link appears and we keep going. And I do that obviously in my phone, because you have text replacement on your phone, and I do it in my computers. So it works out really nicely. So check out Auto Hotkey if you're a Windows user. I don't, that's maybe cool. There's something for Macs like that or no?
Hey, Keyboard Maestro, but I think you have to like pay monthly for that. So I don't.
Oh, Auto Hotkey is free.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Great. Thank you so much for being here with us today. If people want to find out more about you and your work, where should they go?
They can go to my website, which is www.julianreif.com.
Great. Well, that's all that we have for you folks today. Make sure you subscribe and leave a review and tell your friends about our podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Bye.
Thanks.